There is a very specific suffocating silence that, every parent or caretaker knows.
Oh, absolutely. It's terrifying.
Right. It's that sudden, heavy quiet that falls over a house or maybe a park when you turn around and realize the child you were looking at literally a second ago
Yeah.
is just gone.
Just vanished.
Yeah. Your stomach drops, your peripheral vision blurs, and your brain just completely freezes
Which
up.
is the normal human response, really.
Right. So today we are deep diving into a comprehensive crisis protocol from AngelSense. It is an incredibly detailed step-by-step action plan, specifically focused on what to do if an autistic child wanders off.
And it's so needed.
It really is. Our mission
Yeah.
today is to equip you, the listener, with the knowledge to shift immediately from that, paralyzing panic into a clear, actionable plan. Because when those seconds start ticking, you cannot rely on sheer instinct.
No, instinct usually points you in the wrong direction here.
Exactly. You need a rock-solid protocol.
To ground us in why this specific protocol is so necessary, we really have to look at a statistical reality from the source material that is, frankly, it's truly staggering.
Yeah, hit me with it.
A whopping 50% of autistic children wander.
Wow, half of them.
Half. And of those incidents, one quarter require a full multi-agency emergency response.
That's a massive number.
Grant, millions of families are navigating this potential reality every single day.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can even talk about search tactics, we have to understand the psychology as a departure. Like, if an autistic child leaves a safe environment, we have to understand the mechanics behind it.
We have to know the why.
Right. What is actually happening in their brain or, in their environment that triggers them to just walk away?
Well, it generally boils down to a profound disconnect between the child's internal state and their environment. The AngelSense protocol highlights several core triggers here.
Okay, what's the big one?
The most common is sensory overwhelm. For an autistic individual, a buzzing fluorescent light or a chaotic, crowded room doesn't just feel annoying, you know?
It's not just a minor nuisance.
Exactly. It can feel like a physical drill going into their ear. They aren't trying to be defiant. They are desperately seeking relief.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Then you have intense anxiety, or sometimes just pure, unfiltered curiosity. And sometimes it's a communication challenge.
How does that play out?
Well, they might urgently need a break from a room, but they simply do not have the verbal tools to articulate that. So their body just takes over and they leave.
Which frames the wandering less as like running away and more as an urgent coping mechanism.
That's a great way to put it.
The guide also mentions this intense, almost magnetic pull to very specific places, things like bodies of water, busy roads, or familiar playgrounds.
Yeah, that magnetic pull concept is vital for searchers to understand. An autistic brain often craves predictable, rhythmic repetition.
So that's why water is such a big draw.
Precisely. Think about water, the continuous, rhythmic rippling of a pond or a pool. It provides incredibly regulating, predictable sensory feedback to a nervous system that currently feels completely out of control.
It's soothing to them.
It's very soothing.
But wait, if a child is completely overwhelmed by a sensory trigger, or if they are suddenly fixated on bolting to get to a pond, aren't they running away as fast as they can?
That's what you'd think, right?
Yeah, my immediate mental image is a kid just sprinting away at top speed. Like, my brain tells me they are trying to put as much distance as possible between themselves and the house.
Which is the natural assumption that sends caretakers into a blind panic. Interestingly, the source material explicitly corrects that image.
Really?
Yeah. In the vast majority of these cases, the child is most likely to be on foot, but they are not running.
Oh, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Right. They are moving with purpose, absolutely, but they are generally not in a full-blown sprint to escape.
Well, that drastically changes the initial geometry of the search, doesn't it? I mean, if they aren't sprinting a 6-minute mile, they're likely much closer than a panicked brain assumes.
Much closer.
Which brings us to the first 5 minutes of the protocol. The guide treats this almost like a highly structured fire drill.
That's the perfect analogy.
Yeah, like when a fire alarm goes off, you don't run around screaming. You follow a memorized set of steps.
Yeah.
And the very first step here is to check the doors.
Yes, immediately.
According to the protocol, an unlocked door isn't just a mistake. It's your first piece of forensic evidence.
Exactly. Putting on that detective cap is crucial in those first few minutes. If you are generally diligent about keeping doors locked, well, finding the back gate unlatched tells you their exact exit route.
You're finding the story of how they left.
Right. You are looking for the story of their exit. And before you start running down the street, you really have to clear the immediate home area by checking the most obvious familiar hiding spots.
And we're talking about really specific spots here. Closets, the yard, but also inside parked vehicles.
Yes. Because again, we go back to the psychology of it. If they are seeking regulation, small enclosed spaces like a car or a cramped closet, they provide deep physical pressure.
Which acts as a calming mechanism, right?
Exactly, for an overwhelmed nervous system. You have to verify they aren't just seeking deep pressure under a pile of laundry before you assume they are miles away.
Okay, so you've checked the closets, you've checked the cars, you've found an unlocked back door, and they are definitely not on the property. What happens next? Because my instinct says to just jump in the car and start driving around the neighborhood.
And your instinct is wrong here.
It is.
Totally. The moment you clear that immediate home area, the search must escalate instantly. The fire drill goes from the household to the emergency responders. You dial 911 immediately.
Instantly.
Yes.
Do not wait.
The guide actually pulls back the curtain on what happens when you make that call. The dispatcher isn't just sending, like, a single patrol car to take a report. Oh, no. It's a massive response.
Yeah, they dispatch police, they pull in fire units, and they put every local unit in the area on immediate alert. But to do that effectively, the operator needs highly specific information, and they need it faster than a panicked parent can usually stutter it out.
Which is incredibly hard to do when you're terrified.
Exactly. And this is where the pre-prepared emergency package comes in.
Yes, this emergency package is arguably the most critical piece of prep work a family can do. It needs to be printed at home, saved on your phone, and ready to just hand over.
What's in it, exactly?
It includes a recent photo, a description of their clothes, their autism level, known triggers, calming methods, and a list of their favorite places.
I was trying to visualize how this works in practice, and it's essentially like handing the first responders a highly customized user manual for your child.
That's exactly what it is, a user manual.
Because, I mean, standard police rescue tactics usually involve blaring sirens, running up, and shining flashlights. For an autistic child, that standard rescue could be severely traumatizing.
It could make everything worse. And what's fascinating here is the sheer specificity of the questions the police will need answered to adapt their tactics.
Like what?
They will ask things like, does the child respond to their name? Do sirens make them run? Do they actively avoid eye contact? Do they use an augmentative and alternative communication device, an AAC?
Let's break that AAC down for a second, because that feels incredibly important.
Yeah.
If a police officer finds a child, their absolute first move is usually to ask, hey, buddy, are you okay? What's your name?
Right. Standard procedure. But if the child uses an AAC, which is often a tablet or a picture board used to communicate, the officer needs to know that verbal questions are completely useless.
Because they can't answer verbally.
Exactly. If the police don't know the child is nonverbal, they might misinterpret the child's silence as defiance or maybe shock rather than a fundamental communication difference.
Oh, wow.
Knowing about the AAC dictates the physical tactics of the entire rescue operation.
That makes so much sense. And here's where it gets really interesting regarding the tracking theory. We talked about finding that unlocked back door earlier.
You're right, the forensic evidence.
Yeah. The guide points out that handing that specific detail over to the police is a massive tactical advantage.
It is. It gives law enforcement a directional theory.
How so?
Well, if they bring in search dogs, knowing the exact point of departure gives the dogs a clean, uncontaminated starting point. Even without dogs, knowing they went out the back gate towards a wooded area versus the front door towards the sidewalk, it helps police map the terrain and significantly narrows the initial search radius.
So the police are mobilizing with a user manual and a directional theory. But the family and their personal network are also searching at the same time.
Yes, parallel efforts.
And the guide emphasizes this cannot be just a random grid search. It requires a concept called sensory mapping.
Sensory mapping is so crucial. It means you search the high-risk areas by predicting the child's path based on their unique brain wiring.
So you're thinking like they think.
Exactly. The absolute first priority, universally, is bodies of water. Pools, ponds, creeks. As we discussed, that rhythmic water is a magnet and it presents the most immediate lethal danger.
Right. Always check the water first.
Always. Once water is cleared, you map the grid based on their sensory profile.
Meaning you ask yourself, you know, is this child drawn to the quiet isolation of a deserted playground? Or are they sensory seeking, drawn to the loud, chaotic vibration of a noisy highway or a construction site.
You are using their specific triggers as a treasure map, basically.
And to cover that map, the guide says you have to lean on your emergency contacts. Group chats with neighbors, relatives, the bus driver, even the mailman. It really takes a village.
It does.
But reading this, I kept picturing a very specific and honestly dangerous scenario.
What's that?
Well, if a well-meaning neighbor spots the child wandering near a busy road, human nature dictates that they're going to shout the kid's name and sprint toward them to pull them to safety.
Oh, yeah. That is the universal human impulse.
Right.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, that well-meaning human instinct is exactly what the source warns against.
Really?
It is vital that the network is given crystal clear instructions not to chase the child and not to shout at them.
Which feels entirely counterintuitive. I mean, if a kid is near danger, why wouldn't you yell for them to stop?
We have to go back to the fight or flight response. An autistic child who has wandered off is already existing in a state of heightened anxiety or sensory overload. Their nervous system is totally maxed out.
Okay.
If a neighbor suddenly shouts their name and charges at them, the child's brain does not process that as, oh good, rescue has arrived.
How do they process it?
They process it as a predator attack.
Oh my God.
It triggers an immediate blind flight response. They will bolt away from the rescuer, which could send them straight into that busy intersection or deep into a body of water.
That is terrifying.
It is. The village needs to be instructed to keep visual contact, stay calm, and report the location immediately without escalating the child's stress.
So you essentially have to train your neighborhood to act as silent spotters rather than active rescuers.
Yes.
That shifts the whole dynamic. Yeah. Now, humanizing community networks are amazing, but the guide heavily pivots into the digital layer of all this. Modern technology acts as the ultimate objective safety net here.
It removes so much of the human error.
Right. The source runs through utilizing mobile phone location sharing, smartwatch history, pulling footage from neighborhood Ring doorbells, and checking municipal cameras.
Mm.
It even suggests checking the child's recent tablet activity to see if they search for a specific park, acting as a sort of digital tripwire for their intentions.
It's all about replacing panicked guesswork with hard, objective location data.
I do want to push back on the tech aspect just a bit, though.
Okay, go for it.
We live in a world absolutely saturated with smart devices. Most kids eventually have a smartphone, or you can toss a basic Bluetooth tracker in a backpack.
No.
Why does the guide insist on investing in specialized trackers designed specifically for autism wandering, like the Angel Sense device? Doesn't a standard smartphone do the trick?
That's a fair question. But a standard smartphone is basically a convenience tool. What the guide is describing is essentially a life-saving medical device. There are several stark differences.
Like what?
First off, a smartphone can easily be left on a kitchen counter, right? And its battery dies quickly. But the major factor is sensory sensitivity.
Ah, right. We talked about that.
Many autistic children will simply rip off a standard smartwatch or refuse to carry a phone because the material or the weight bothers them. The specialized trackers mentioned in the source are built with sensory-friendly wearable designs.
Which makes total sense. If an ordinary watch band feels like sandpaper on their skin, it's coming off in 3 seconds.
Exactly. The best GPS tech in the world is completely useless if the hardware itself is a sensory trigger.
Precisely. It has to become a seamless part of their wardrobe.
Beyond the wearability, specialized systems feature auto geofencing. You can think of this as a digital tripwire around the perimeter of the house or school.
Oh, I like that.
It proactively alerts you the absolute second they cross that boundary, rather than you having to manually check their location after you finally notice the house is too quiet.
That's huge. The guide also mentions remote listen-in features, which sounds intense, but incredibly useful in a crisis.
It is invaluable. These devices have remotely activated alarms, microphones, and speakers. If the child crosses the geofence, a caretaker can open the microphone and literally listen to the child's environment.
So you can hear what's around them?
Yes. Are there cars rushing by? Do you hear the rustling of woods? Do you hear water? You can also speak directly through the device to offer calming words, and these systems often integrate directly with law enforcement portals.
Feeding real-time GPS coordinates directly to the police dispatch.
Exactly. It cuts out the middleman.
So the police are tracking the live coordinates, the network is holding visual contact. What happens when someone actually reaches them? Finding the child is the primary goal, obviously, but the protocol makes it very clear that the physical and emotional handling of the reunion is critical for the child's well-being.
It's a very delicate moment.
Very. The immediate physical steps are strict. You approach gently. Do not rush. Conduct a rapid visual check for injuries. Have they been exposed to extreme heat or freezing cold? Are their clothes wet from falling in a creek?
You have to assess them instantly.
Right. Provide a drink. Immediately reduce the sensory input around them. Maybe get them into a quiet car and hand them a preferred calming item. And the guide notes a trip to the ER might be entirely necessary.
Yeah, the physical assessment must be immediate and thorough because depending on their communication level or their state of shock, they may not be able to articulate that they twisted an ankle or, you know, swallowed dirty water.
So what does this all mean for the emotional handling of this situation? Because as a parent or a caretaker, you are coming down from the absolute worst adrenaline spike of your life.
You're crashing.
You are exhausted. You are likely crying. And a part of you might be intensely angry at the sheer terror of it all. But the protocol stresses that caretakers must focus entirely on comfort and emotional reassurance. There can be strictly no blame and absolutely no punishment.
And that's so hard to do in the moment, but it's essential. Because the caretaker's panic is secondary to the child's trauma. Ultimately, no one knows what that child just endured while they were out there.
That's so true.
They might have been terrified by loud noises. They might have been lost and confused. They might have had negative encounters with strangers. Projecting adult anger or punishment onto them in that fragile moment of reunion only compounds their trauma.
It teaches them that being found is a negative experience.
Exactly.
The guide adds a really practical layer to this emotional protection, specifically regarding the police.
Yes, and this requires parents to act as a shield. If the police are present and naturally want to ask the child questions to complete their incident report, the parents should actively advocate for the child.
How do they do that?
If the child is dysregulated, nonverbal, or incapable of answering, the parents must ask the police to delay the questioning. The psychological safety of the child takes absolute precedence over wrapping up the bureaucratic paperwork on the scene.
The paperwork can wait until the nervous system is regulated.
Exactly.
And once the dust has really settled and the child is secure, the protocol moves to the aftermath, the debrief.
This raises an important question for families. Like, how do you review the incident without it turning into a toxic blame game?
Right, because tensions are high.
Very high. But the post-incident review is not about pointing fingers at who forgot to latch the gate. It is about systematically finding the gap in the safety plan.
You're taking the new data and updating the user manual.
Exactly. You ask the hard questions. Was there a specific sensory trigger that caused this flight? Did a neighbor start using a loud leaf blower?
Or was there a sudden disruption to their daily schedule that caused underlying anxiety?
Right. How did they physically bypass the lock and what route did they take? Because as a child grows, their baselines shift. A lock that kept a 5-year-old safe might be easily outsmarted by an 8-year-old.
And the source points out a very grounded, sobering reality here. You can have the most expensive locks, the best alarms, and the tightest protocols, but kids sometimes wander at night when the entire house is sleeping.
It's a terrifying thought, but it's real.
Yeah. Unless you are going to hire a 24-hour guard, zero risk simply does not exist. Reviewing and continuously adapting your physical locks, updating school protocols, and refining your supervision routines is the best defense available.
It is a constant evolution. Learning about autism safety, whether that is mastering water safety, understanding the deep mechanics of meltdowns, or managing sensory inputs, is an ongoing journey.
It never really ends.
No, but the most vital message from the source material is that families do not have to handle this in isolation. The tools exist, the actionable protocols exist, and the broader community can be trained to help effectively.
It transforms an incredibly isolating fear into a manageable, community-supported plan. Reading through this Angel Sense guide, what really stood out to me is that preparation doesn't just mitigate the panic of the adults. It actively supports a delicate balance between safety and independence for the child.
Which is what everyone wants.
Exactly. With the right sensory-friendly trackers, a solid emergency package, and an educated network, autistic children still get the freedom to explore and exist in the world. You aren't locking them in a sterile bubble. You are building a smarter, invisible safety net around them.
Beautifully said.
But, you know, spending all this time in the source material, looking at the immense labor families undertake changing locks, buying specialized trackers, mapping out sensory dangers, it left me with a final thought I want to pass on to you listening at home.
Oh.
Yeah. This guide focuses entirely on how caretakers must adapt their homes and routines to protect wandering children. But it raises a profound societal question. If 50% of autistic children wander, why isn't this statistic heavily factored into modern urban planning.
That is a really interesting point.
Consider how our neighborhoods, our public parks, and our school campuses are built. Imagine if they were designed from the ground up to naturally mitigate these sensory pulls. Imagine parks with natural safe boundaries and sensory-friendly zones, rather than leaving the crushing burden of adaptation entirely on the shoulders of the parents.
That is a powerful perspective to consider for the future of community design.
Because the next time you experience that stomach-dropping moment of looking at an empty space where a child just was, you shouldn't have to feel like the very architecture of the world is working against you. Something to mull over as you look at the layout of your own neighborhood today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.